lost in the fog of a cosmic storm. Floating on whimsical wavelengths is the norm. Dancing through the stars, chasing spectrums of light. Riding the waves that are just out of sight.
It's time for Whimsical Wavelengths, where we dive into all parts of science, from the stars and quasars to the life all around us. This week is a completely new topic, and again, I love this. I really do. Have you subscribed, left a rating, sent any feedback through email or social media, made suggestions for future shows? The answer is no. Well, get on it. I mean, really. So, the topic this time is all about insects. No need to cover the question of what a fly is without wings, because the answer is simple. It would be called a wok. Now, we are going to get into some technical things about how they, work, I guess. So what is an insect? Like its definition, they are, in general, invertebrates, i.e. they're lacking a backbone. They have three body segments, head, abdomen, and thorax. Jointed legs that are attached to the thorax. They're hexapoda, meaning they have six legs, antennas on the head. Two compound eyes, usually situated on either side of the head. And quite frankly, insects represent so much of the biomass on Earth. Depending on the study and the methods used, there's more weight on Earth within insects in general than there are with humans. And with over 8 billion humans on Earth, and each one of us weighing a lot more than an insect, you get the picture, there's a lot of them. They form the backbone of many ecosystems. You also don't need to be an accountant to be good at math and look up those numbers. You know, the song Ants Marching by Dave Matthews Band came up a few times while I was writing this. Today, though, we are specifically going to focus on their respiratory system. How do they breathe? It's not like they have lungs or gills like a fish. I vaguely remember grade school biology and going over the number of legs and the like, just as I did just a few moments ago. You know what, though? I've never really given it much thought. Like, how do they breathe? And quite frankly, I have now given it some thought, and I'm intrigued. Stealing the words from today's guest. With over 1 million identified species of insect, they're a great vehicle for studying evolution. There are all kinds of new things coming out of it. Probably the most significant of which is flight. So let's get into it. Time to follow the buzz and see if the anticipation I am chirping about is going to fly over our heads. So please welcome Dr. Hollister Horhold, a research associate in the Division of Intervertebrate Zoology and a research scientist in the Department of Astrophysics at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City.
Hi.
I'm glad you're here. And I guess this is so far outside of what I understand and know anything about. So let's start with the common question of how we end up where we do. So what brought you to New York to study the respiratory system of insects?
It's a bit of a long and convoluted story.
That's what podcasts are for, so this is perfect.
So my background is I was actually a software engineer for about 15 years. My bachelor's degree is in computer science. And I worked on a range of things from ultrasound machines, cell phone base stations, and things like that. I was an embedded systems engineer. And then when my kids were born and kind of hit, you know, a certain age, I was a stay-at-home dad for about 12 years. And when they hit, you know, school age, I started volunteering in museums. We were in Houston at the time, and I volunteered at the Houston Museum of Natural Science. And I was a docent there for a few years and got into paleontology. And I did some fossil prep. Vertebrate fossil prep for a little while. And then we had an exhibit on fossil insects, specimens from the Museum of Natural History here in New York. And the curator, Dave Grimaldi, brought down about 150 or so insects in amber. We had a big, huge exhibit, and I learned a lot about insects. And at the time, we were living in Houston, but I knew we were going to be transferred back to the Northeast. We're basically from around here, more or less. And I said, hey, do you guys use volunteers? He's like, yeah, sure. And so when we arrived in New Jersey, I came into the museum in New York and started working with him. And I started doing CT scanning of insects in amber because insects preserve really, really well. I mean, the fossil record of insects is actually very good. And you don't get like, you know, T-Rexes and dinosaurs, you know, they keep the lights on here. But but you never really get a whole specimen. You get like, you know, they're very incomplete. But insects, you get the whole animal. You get everything. And it's all preserved really well. And when you put them in a CT scanner, you get a really great three-dimensional view of the inside and the outside of this fossil. And so I worked on that for a while. And then we started scanning some live stuff, looking at the internals of extant insects that are, you know, around today. And we started looking at respiratory systems of insects, the tracheal system, which I'll get to in a little bit. And one day we were looking at them and Dave goes, oh, this would be a pretty good dissertation. And I'm like, oh, really? So he's like, you should apply to grad school. I'm like, you're insane. He's like, don't say that. It's not that. I'm like, okay, fine. So the museum has a small graduate program, the Richard Gilder Graduate School. And there's only about, you know, 16 to 20 students at any given point in time. And it's an accelerated four-year program. So I applied to that and I got in and my dissertation was on CT scanning of insects for insect respiration. And then when I finished that, I kind of stuck around at the museum still doing research and soft money grants and things like that. And then, yeah, so that's kind of the long story.
Perfect. Well, after all that time within the fossil record as well as insects of today, do you have a favorite species or do they all bug you the same?
They all bug me the same. So yeah, sometimes they're all kind of unique in there and different in different ways. Because you know, with a million species of identified insects, you know, the diversity and of form and function, disparity and size is just immense. Insects are a fantastic vehicle for studying evolution because they've been around, you know, insects were the first animals to fly, for example. They took to the skies 100 million years before any pterosaur or bird. And so just their adaptations for that and other things like that, you know, you find insects in every terrestrial scenario. The only place where you don't find insects is out in the open ocean. But other than that, you find them everywhere. And so they're just really fantastic vehicle for all kinds of questions and studies and things like that.
Okay, so to edge into what we're talking about, and as I said in the intro, I never really gave any thought as to how insects breathe before being introduced to you through email. So why don't we start with why we humans need to breathe? Like, why do we, like, obviously I know, but let's hear it from you so that way we can get it into the realm of insects. Like, why do humans need to breathe?
Yeah, so cellular respiration basically is, you know, oxygen is used for to power basic metabolic processes, you know, in the body. And so humans and, you know, vertebrates, all vertebrates breathe basically the same way. And that's the same as, you know, you or me or fish or you know, antelope. It's all basically the same. You breathe air into your lungs where gas exchange occurs and oxygen is taken up into hemoglobin molecules in your blood and into red blood cells, which are basically bags of hemoglobin. They don't have a nucleus. And then it's the responsibility of your circulatory system to pump blood throughout your body to provide access to oxygen for respiratory gas exchange in all the tissues everywhere. And so this you know, venous and arterial and venous system, you know, make up the cardiopulmonary system that provides oxygen to wherever it's needed. And this is the same if you're, you know, if you're a fish, same thing, you're just getting the oxygen out of the water versus out of the air. So this linkage between these two systems is the same for all vertebrates. Insects are quite a bit different. They have a hard chitinized exoskeleton. It's segmented. You know, you've seen insects and they all have segments. Chitin is basically what the exoskeleton is made of. The chitin is for instance, keratin is the protein that makes up your fingernails and your hair, whereas a chitin is what makes up the exoskeleton of an insect. You know, crabs, you know, horseshoe crabs and insects, they all use chitin. That's what makes up the exoskeleton. So it's a polysaccharide, I think. I can't remember exactly what it is. Anyway, each segment in an insect has holes in the sides called spiracles that lead to a network of tubes called trachea that penetrate into the body that provide direct access to air for respiratory gas exchange. So you have these tubes that in this branching network get smaller and smaller and smaller, and they go right up against the mitochondria that are in the cells that use the oxygen to basically make energy to make the cells work. And so you can kind of think of insects as having a distributed respiratory system like throughout their body. So you get these very, very complex networks that go all throughout the body. And previously, to study this, it required dissection. It's the basic way people have been used, you know, have been studying insect internals for hundreds of years since the advent of the first microscopes. You cut open the exoskeleton, you pry it open, and you look inside. You see what you can see. Trachea, the tubes that provide air for respiratory gas exchange, they're very, very thin and very, very membranous because gas has to pass through them. And when you pry open the exoskeleton, you just moved a bunch of stuff around. So it's very, very difficult to see where things are in situ. Also, dissection is a really painstaking and time-consuming and arduous and very requires a lot of skill to do accurate dissections, not to mention you have to like diagram things very, very carefully. And so there's not a lot of what we call comparative studies on insect internals in a lot of ways. They'll dissect like two or three different things and say, okay, this is the way it is. Well, in reality, there's like a million species of identified insects, probably another 4 million that have not even been discovered yet. So what my dissertation, go ahead.
Where'd you get the number 4 million hasn't been discovered yet?
So that's an interesting question. So basically, there are 1 million described species of insects. So right. If you look in the scientific literature, there's 1 million species that have all been, you know, written down and named. We find new undocumented insects all the time. So a while ago, somebody did a study in the tropics where they did an estimate of how many species have been discovered and how many are not known. And so they basically did what's called canopy fogging in a particular area, and they got, you know, the populations of all the insects in this one spot, and they looked at how many have been documented and how many are not yet written up. And the estimate from that study actually was that there may be as many as 20 million total species of insects worldwide, because you find some species of insects that you only find them on a single tree. The diversity, you know, the estimated diversity of insect species ranges anywhere from 5 million total to maybe 20 to 30 million total. I kind of come down in the 5 million-ish range by the rate of like how fast we keep discovering new species in the different localities where I have not really been investigated that much yet. But basically, there are many, many, many more species out there that have not been discovered.
Okay. We're totally getting off track now, but if you discover one, you're going to name it, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So do you, obviously it changes a little bit depending on the type of insects you discover, but do you have like a name in mind that you would mold into it already? Or is it going to be something like kind of spur of the moment?
It depends, because many species like the levels of classification that you go through from the top to bottom are, you know, kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. So insects is a class. Are we going to find new classes of things? Probably not. Family, we do find new families of things every now and then, usually in the fossil record. And then, order, family, genus, species, new orders. There's actually a new order of insects that was discovered around 2006, Mantophasmatodea. They're heel walkers. They look like mantises, and they're only in sub-Saharan Africa. So there was a new order of insects discovered not that long ago, and there are 30 orders of insects. So that's a pretty big division there. New families are written up relatively often, usually in the fossil record as we find new deposits and things like that. New genera. Those happen relatively often. New species is very often. So a lot of things that you find are in existing, they have an existing genus. So you find something that's very closely related to something that's already named. And so, you know, like Drosophila melanogaster, maybe you find a new species of Drosophila and you name it, you know, and there's rules that are kind of followed as far as nomenclature, how you name these things. So it's like Drosophila, you know, something, you know, long appendix for like, they have long legs or longer, you know, things like that. So can you just name something randomly in insects, whatever you want to name? There's some rules, but generally, you know, you can name it after a person, you can name it after a particular body feature, but like there are entomologists here at the museum and they've named upwards of like between 500 and 700 species. So if you name a dinosaur, that's like a big deal. If you aim an insect, you know, it happens.
Makes sense. Okay, so let's, I guess, try to
get
back on. Hey, it's mostly my fault, too. Okay, so gas exchange, we're talking about in with the good, out with the bad, and it doesn't seem to matter whether we're dealing with fish or humans or insects.
Yep.
And when it comes to humans, just to kind of go through a summary of how we breathe, it's in through the mouth, travels down our trachea into our lungs, where it branches into the bronchioles, and then which are branching tubes that eventually end in alveoli. There we go. The small sacs of air where the oxygen and carbon dioxide are actually exchanged through the walls, which are very thin through a process we call diffusion, which just means that it can enter and exit the membrane by itself.
Yep.
Okay.
Osmosis and diffusion. Yep.
When we're talking about insects, so instead of dealing with mouth, trachea, bronchioles, etc., we're doing, what is it, spheral? I'm just going to leave it to you because I don't remember already.
So basically, it provides, so the tracheal system, the tubes going into the body, you don't need the active respiration necessarily of moving the air in and out. That does happen in some insects, and it was thought for a long time that basically passive diffusion was all you needed because there's so many tubes going in throughout the body. It turns out that if you do look at some insects, like if you happen to look at like a, you know, a bee on a flower, you can sometimes see its abdomen pumping, things like that. That's actually a compressing the tracheal system to move air in and out. So they do breathe a little bit. It's not exactly the same as like your diaphragm moving in and out like you do if you're a vertebrate, you know, if you're a human or you know, a mammal, or moving your gills if you're a fish. But there is some active ventilation that does occur in insects to kind of move the CO2 out and help move oxygen in.
Okay, but they're called the spherical trachea, and then there was smaller tubes as well, right?
So the spiracles are the holes.
Spiracles are the holes. So that's like the equivalent to our mouth, I guess.
Yeah, you can think of it as basically nostrils running down the side of the body.
Okay.
Multiple sets of nostrils. You can kind of think of it that way. They do not breathe through their mouth.
Yeah.
Mouth is only for eating. So they have basically these nostrils all running down the sides of the body that penetrate all the way through.
Okay, so they have a whole bunch of these holes or nostrils or whatever you want to call them all over their bodies. So they don't have a central way to, like we do, using our heart and our blood.
Correct.
Although the basic gas exchange function mechanisms are kind of the same.
Yep.
So do they just have like hundreds of thousands of meters of little tubes running everywhere, or do they use blood like we do?
They do not use blood like we do. So the circulatory system, they have blood. It's called hemolymph. It doesn't serve the same function as our blood. Our blood, one of the primary functions is for respiratory gases. They do have blood, and it does circulate in a different way. They kind of like have a... So our venous system is sort of closed. You know, it goes, there's tubes that run through the body, and it goes through your heart, and then out, and then through your heart, and then through your heart, and so on and so forth. Insects have the exoskeleton, and then inside the exoskeleton there's all the organs, and then there's hemolymph that kind of bathes everything, and there is a heart that runs dorsally that kind of like pumps things around in what's called the hemocell, which is sort of the inside cavity inside the insect. And so the heart kind of pumps and moves that around, but it's not for gas exchange. It's for, you know, other metabolic processes, for digestion and things like that, and then some of the immune system works that way. But it's not, they don't pump oxygenated blood throughout their body. They rely on the fact that you've got this tube that's carrying oxygen running right up next to that flight muscle, for example, that provides air, you know, for oxygen to run the muscle.
Well, it's, I think, weird. That's weird. Yeah. Makes me have all other sorts of questions. I mean, just so many questions. If I just pause and think for a few moments, it's like, let's just get to the basics of like what an insect is and its life cycle. Humans change and grow with age, but the structures in place at birth roughly stay the same. Our head is where our head is. Our heart is where our heart is. Yeah, things grow, but they stay roughly constant. An insect, though, they change a lot more, don't they? Do they like rebuild themselves like pieces of Lego when they go into their different stages?
Many insects do, yes. So there's a big division between insect. Well, so there's holometabolous insects. Those are ones that go through complete metamorphosis. So they start out as an egg, and then they hatch and there's a larva. And then at some point they turn into a pupa, which for some things like a cocoon, basically, but the pupal form is different for different insects. Basically, it's a cocoon. And then they emerge from that cocoon, the pupa, as an adult. So egg, larva, pupa, adult. Those are holometabolous insects. And those comprise, you know, the big four orders, which are flies, Diptera, Coleoptera, beetles, Lepidoptera, moths and butterflies, and Hymenoptera, which are ants, wasps, and bees. Those are like the four big holometabolous orders that comprise many species. Those are all holometabolous insects, egg, larva, pupa, adult. There are a bunch of other insects, though, that do not do complete metamorphosis. They go egg, larva, adult. So, for instance, dragonflies. They lay an egg, and then there's a larva. The larvae are all aquatic, and they go through many, many, many molts of the larva. And each successive molt, they you know, split open their exoskeleton, and a new one comes out. And they can go through what are called instars, and they can go through many different instars, many different molts, until they get to the adult stage. So there's kind of two different ways that insects do this. And the one that you're thinking of where they do like the essentially huge remodeling, you know, like butterflies, for example. When a butterfly goes into a cocoon, you know, that caterpillar does not look like a butterfly. And when it comes out, oh my gosh, I'm a beautiful butterfly. So yeah, those are the ones where you see like the extensive remodeling of the body. And then if your question is, what happens to like the respiratory system when that happens?
Yeah, that's my question.
I would love to know, and I do not know yet. So yeah, my studies thus far have focused all on adults. But yeah, on the list of things to do is to look at, you know, larvae and pupae and see like what happens during metamorphosis to the respiratory system. I do not know.
Is that like just for taking a very simplistic view on us, can you just like CT scan the same thing as it goes through the metamorphosis process within the cocoon?
You have to be very careful with that because you're dosing it with ionizing radiation and a lot of it. And so are you affecting development when you're doing that?
Right.
So, and depending on the scan and the scanner and so on and so forth, I mean, one way of doing it is synchrotron. So we have CT scanners here at the museum, and they're relatively low power, but it's, you know, it's substantial. But there was a study that was done using a synchrotron, which is a particle accelerator. It's a ring, and you spin electrons up, you know, really fast. And as they go around corners, they emit X-rays, really, really bright X-rays. And so people have done that to do various studies of things and get really fast exposures. But you really heavily dose it, and you can, you know, you'll kill insects with dosages like that. So the thing is with a lot of these is that you can get specimens in various developmental stages. And so you just freeze it, or, you know, you basically you freeze it, you kill it, and then you scan it. So you get them at successive times. You can do that relatively straightforward.
Okay, so you're in the process of finding grant money to do that.
Yes. Short answer to that question is yes.
Yeah, it's always more complicated than that, but nevertheless. Okay, so let's like look at the document that you sent me as like the peer-reviewed research paper to try to get technical about, because that's kind of my formula for the show. And by far, it is the longest document featured here on Whimsical Wavelengths. It's not a thesis, but it isn't exactly your standard journal article either. So let's take a brief detour of the sausage making of science, because it's also important. So the documented case here is Comparative Anatomy of the Insect Tracheal Systems, Part 1, Introduction, Apterogotes, Paleopetra, Polyneptra, I'm pronouncing them terribly, published in the Bulletin of American Museum of Natural History. So most listeners are likely familiar, even if you're not in sciences, with the journals of Nature and Science. They tend to be only 4 pages long. They're punchy. You don't have a lot of space to get into anything complex. But what is the Bulletin of American Museum of Natural History in comparison?
So the museum has its own publications department. Museum's a little over 150 years old, and there are a number of journals that the museum publishes and has published for quite some time. The two primary ones are the Bulletin, and another one called Novitatis. And they focus on things that a lot of other journals won't necessarily publish. In particular, the Bulletin publishes long format articles and papers and studies and stuff. Typically what we call monographs, which used to be published more, but aren't so much these days because, you know, publication wise, there's just not a lot of money in it and there's not a lot of impact factor in it, but it really is important work. For example, revisions or descriptions of large groups of animals, insects, mammals, whatever, where people go through and in detail do morphological descriptions of even dinosaurs, things like that, where you really need a lot of figures, a lot of descriptions, and we're aware that it's not going to sell a lot, but that kind of work really is important for the other work and that you see in like Science Nation PNS to be done. So there's a lot of foundational work that's done in things like the Bulletin. And the Bulletin is really the only place where you can do things like that, where you can do like 184-page paper and they'll go, okay, yeah, sure. And it's published by the museum. It's funded by the museum. And so museum staff can do it. If you're affiliated with the museum too, you can do it. So, or if you're working with someone who's affiliated with the museum, you can publish in there. So it's peer reviewed. It's not, you know, and it's outside reviewers. We don't do just museum staff. It's like it's not like an all museum, you know, internal magazine. It's a legit peer reviewed journal. It's been around for 100 years or more, actually.
Yeah, and I think that's important to flag is like there are a number of different journals out there and each one has its own lane, so to speak, and not all of them can be Nature and Science. And I've written my own papers and couldn't do them in 4 pages if I wanted to and still have it make sense and give enough that if somebody wanted to follow my footsteps, they could test it. But I get the feeling like this is more, for the lack of a better word, like a survey designed study where you're providing the baseline research for things that'll come in the future. So is that fair?
Correct. Yeah, that is correct. So previous to this, there were no broad comparative studies of insect respiratory structures. It had been done on select groups or individuals. For some reason, people really focused a lot on dragonflies and tried to extrapolate those results to all of insects. Dragonflies are really different from everything else. And so this is the first foray into looking at, you know, many different insect orders and doing a comparative study of looking at what are the different structures that we see in all of them. And most importantly, what are the homologies? So a homology is something that is a characteristic that comes from a common ancestor. For example, I was going to say like different hearing organs in insects, but actually hearing has evolved in insects 20 separate times. So that's not really a very good example. But one that is interesting actually deals with the flight apparatus of insects that I talked a little bit about in the paper. And that is there's a connection. So the insects are divided into head, thorax, abdomen. The thorax is in the middle, and it's really the locomotor apparatus of the whole insect. The wings come from there, the legs come from there. So everything that deals with like moving the insect around, that's in the thorax. Abdomen is digestion, reproduction, so on and so forth. And the head is basically navigation. So in the thorax, there are 2 spiracles on either side. So there's 4 holes where air comes in. And there's connections running from front to back on those spiracles. And on those connections, there are connections branching off of those that like go up into the wings, for example. And one of the questions was, where and when did this structure evolve of these trachea that go up into the wings? Did it evolve convergently, meaning all these insects that fly differently, did they make it differently? And it did, you know, there is no common ancestor for these and so on and so forth. Well, it turns out that these connections are present even in insects that ancestrally do not fly. Silverfish, Zygentema, they do not have wings. They've never had wings. Their ancestor did not have wings. They don't fly. The next orders down, mayflies and dragonflies, they're closely related to those. They both fly. The question is, where did those apparatus for these wing trachea evolve? It actually evolved in the basal order, Zygentema, that doesn't fly. These structures are already present there that are going to be co-opted in later on in evolutionary time to be able to provide air to all these structures that are flying. So like the ground plan for flight structures was already there even in the insects that did not fly, which is really interesting. That was really was not known a lot before this, but being able to look for these homologous structures and where are they present in the common ancestors of all these things was really important. And so what we did was basically make an atlas of tracheal architecture that we can use to sort of figure out where do all these patterns emerge and what can we say about processes. Evolutionary biology is all about looking for patterns and then inferring evolutionary processes from them. What can we say about how did this evolve? So it's all about looking for common things and figuring out what can we say about those.
Right. So I have another question. Was there an evolutionary reason that these systems developed into where the wings are now before wings arrived? Like, is there a reason why they would have developed in a way that would make this possible?
I do not know. That is an excellent question. And one of the things that people think about a lot is when and how did flight develop? They think about it a lot in birds, for example, because like feathers, you know, feathers showed up way before flight showed up. And people think that one of the reasons that feathers showed up is for insulation. You know, they were endothermic animals, you know, warm-blooded. So they need some kind of insulation. Another reason that they probably showed up is for what's called sexual selection. So basically, you know, the male birds tend to have very colorful plumage and stuff like that. And the females go for that kind of thing. And these variations are selected for in certain ways in the evolutionary record, you know, for, you know, if the females tend to like the birds with the bigger plumage or smaller plumage, those characters will continue on because they're selected for, you know what I mean? If that makes sense. So some things we can say, why are they being selected for? And some things we cannot, as far as why did these show up and how did flight evolve in insects? That's a very, very open question. We're not even exactly sure exactly how wings develop. We have a pretty good idea of it, but it's not totally solid. So why did these structures show up in these things that don't even have wings? That is an excellent question.
Okay, well, let's go back to the title real quick.
Yeah,
this was part one. I assume there is a part two?
It's in process, yes.
Oh, it's in process. Is it going to be just as big?
I hope not.
Okay.
This was 7 years of work.
Yeah, I could imagine. And throughout all of this, you used a CT scan. So wavelengths were whimsically a part of this story.
Yes.
Okay. So feel free to bring in part two that isn't out yet, but which species had the most surprising results? I mean, to me, all the diagrams were surprising considering I had never really previously spent much time thinking about how insects breathe. So the first diagram to me was just as surprising as the last, but surely there must have been something there that surprised you more than the rest.
So some of the ones that really kind of I thought were particularly interesting is that one of them, the most basal order of insects, Archaeognathes, they're also called bristletails. The one thing that was surprising about them is that in all other orders of insects, there are these longitudinal connections between segments, tubes that run the length of the body that connect the respiratory system from the head all the way to the tail. In bristletails, that's not the case. And for much of the body, each segment has its own independent respiratory system. It doesn't connect to anything else. It's like, that's really weird. And we didn't expect to find that at all. That was very strange. But no other orders of insects have that at all. Another thing that was interesting was in the most basal flying orders of insects are dragonflies and mayflies. It has been thought for a really long time that those two are closely related, and that forms a group called Paleoptera that is then related to the rest of insects called Neoptera, and that's, you know, flight developed a little bit differently in those two groups. However, the respiratory system of mayflies is much different than dragonflies. Mayflies have a single trunk that runs the length of the body. Dragonflies actually have four. The rest of insects have three, for example. And so dragonflies are actually more like the rest of insects than they are like mayflies. So my hypothesis is that actually mayflies are different from everything else, and dragonflies are more closely related to the rest of insects. So there's different hypotheses for this, and they have both molecular and morphological support and so on and so forth. But this is the first study that kind of tied in respiratory architectures to this. There's other things that we found that were just kind of weird, like Ecstatosoma is this spiny leaf insect, and we looked at it, and the tracheal system of that literally looks like a package of ramen noodles. And so we called it raminiform to name that particular architecture. We thought about noodliferous, but that didn't sound as scientific. So raminiform is the one that we went with for describing that.
Yeah, that one's much better. You end up with things like super volcano, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's got to at least pretend.
Yes. Well, in Astra, I mean, because hanging out in Astra now and listening to all the astronomy types, they need to think up better names for telescopes, because they have like the very large telescope, the extremely large telescope, the very extremely large telescope, the really, really, really big telescope. It's like, those aren't very descriptive. Oh, and my favorite, the overwhelmingly large telescope. That's another one.
Really?
I think so.
Damn. I'll have to bug my uncle about that.
Yeah.
He probably knows who has been naming these.
Probably. Yeah. If he doesn't know them, he knows of them.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Circling back, the bristle tails. Is that what you called them?
Yep. Archaeognatha is the order name. Yeah.
Yeah. So are they like more quote unquote primitive in comparison to other insects because they don't have a connected respiratory system?
So we have to be really careful sometimes about, we would say, they're more primitive and so on and so forth. The thing about it, though, is that, and they talk about, you've probably seen horseshoe crabs. You know, people say they're like living fossils, or, people, they actually caught a coelacanth in the 60s. They thought it had been extinct for hundreds of million years, and then they caught one out in the ocean, and it's like, no, they're still around. And so people call these things, like living fossils, or they're like, they're primitive and so on and so forth. Everything that's alive today on Earth has been subject to the same amount of evolutionary time. So everything is just as evolved as everything else. It just so happens, though, that some things, some body plans and some adaptations are really advantageous, and they've worked well for a long time, like sharks. Sharks are quite old, but it's not like they stopped evolving. Right. They still go through, they have variation, and just those variations happen to be selected out because they're not as advantageous. Everything's still evolving. And so Archaeognathae are the most, we say it's like the most basal order. They're the most primitive looking insects because they have preserved a lot of the characteristics that they had hundreds of millions of years ago. So yeah, they're the most primitive order, and they haven't changed a lot. So, if you find them in the fossil record, they look like they look today. So similar to like horseshoe crabs. So yeah, they're the most primitive.
Okay, so let's pivot to some bigger stuff now. How are we going to use some of this baseline research to really test something like flight? I mean, you've talked about it, but we haven't really, how do you move this forward to actually look at the evolution of flight?
So there's a number of components to that. One of them is that I've done a little bit of work on is quantification of flight performance, which is kind of a fancy way of saying, how well does something fly? And previously, they kind of said, this is a good flyer, that's a bad flyer, this is a really, really good flyer, that's kind of so-so, so on and so forth. It's hard to be able to do comparative metrics on these things if you're really using qualitative kinds of things. So in my dissertation, I put together, the bulletin is one of the chapters of my dissertation. So another chapter, I looked at basically putting some rough numbers on some of these characteristics, where basically I did 0 to 5. 5 is you can do sustained hover, which is things like some bees, some dragonflies, that's like really top end flight performance. Next down, number 4, is you can fly really well, you're very fast, it's controlled flight, you can't do sustained hover, like house flies. Houseflies are very, very good. They're very agile. They can't hover. Next down is three. You can get where you want to go, but it doesn't necessarily look pretty. That's like many moths, lots of butterflies. Two is you can't really fly very well at all. That would be like a mayfly. So you're basically you can get into the air and then you rely on the wind to move you around.
What about a grasshopper?
Grasshopper is probably a one or a two depending, because they kind of like they jump and glide and then they kind of land. They don't really fly per se. They're more gliding. Depending. Some of them fly quite well. So it depends on the species. It's hard to generalize to say like grasshoppers do this. And then you've got zero, which is like they don't have wings.
Right.
So when I take these categories of basically flight performance, and then I look at, a CT scan is really good for doing these kinds of analysis because you can very accurately measure what is the volume of air inside an insect. We can measure the tracheal volume quite well because we know the resolution of the scan and we know how many voxels are air. And so we can easily make a measurement of the investiture of tracheal volume in an insect. How much of an insect is actually respiratory volume or air? And it turns out that insects that fly really, really well allocate more of their body volume for respiration than insects that don't fly well. So a dragonfly, for example, is about 50% air. They're remarkably hollow.
That was like my next question. Like to a T. I was like, what? A thought occurred to me as I was diving into this material and I didn't read it because I can't. It's a bit hard to read a dense volume like you produce.
Yeah.
Especially for someone like me who's a volcanologist, geophysicist. I'm so lost in the jargon pretty quickly. So I was like, so many insects fly. Do insects have more of these hollow areas like birds to help them stay afloat because they're less dense, essentially?
Yes.
And the answer is yes.
Yes. And basically, the better an insect flies, the more space it has allocated to air and respiration in its body.
Cool. And I guess those same ones that can hover and stuff, they also have more adaptations to push air in and out as well?
That is exactly correct. So some insects actually have valves in their respiratory system that facilitates unidirectional airflow. So birds, for example, I don't know if you know, birds have unidirectional airflow through their lungs. So our lungs, we breathe air in and we breathe it out and breathe it in and breathe it out. And there's a little bit of a dead space at the bottom of your lungs where, you know, it takes a little while for that particular space to cycle out. It happens, but not as fast. Birds, air flows one way through the lungs. There's no dead space there. It's continuous flow through. And they exploit air sacs throughout their body to be able to do that. So when they breathe in, there's a little bit of weird cycling thing that goes on there. They breathe in, it goes through the lungs, and they breathe out, and some of it goes into the air sacs, and some of it goes out the lung. You know, it's kind of a weird plumbing system they have there to be able to permit that. And insects, a lot of insects, it appears that the ones that fly well do similar things. They have a set of valves in there that while they're flying, they're actually compressing their body a bit, and that facilitates air moving in and out through the spiracles, and it appears that it facilitates unidirectional airflow through the flight motor to be able to get oxygen really well.
Yay, my intuition was correct.
These are all excellent questions. These are all, you know, these are all things that we think about, like, I don't know. Yep. These are all things that we want to look at.
Okay. Time for a complete pivot away from flight to size. I assume the larger the insect, I would imagine the more difficult it would be to get effective gas exchange across the whole body without muscles pumping it or something, right? So, I mean, without blood as a delivery mechanism, what adaptations do the largest insects have to have?
Lots of air sacs. Same thing. So basically, one of the ways insects get larger is by having big, fat, larger trachea and lots of air sacs.
Okay, so does that... Like
a hissing cockroach, for example, they're pretty big. It's about 40% air.
Damn. And they fly at, what, a one?
They're a one. But ancestrally, they have wings, but they don't fly.
Okay, so I've heard a lot of talk over maybe sci-fi or whatever, not science related necessarily, that there's a certain limit to the size of an insect. And is that, could that also be partly due to its ability to breathe, or is it just the sheer strength of the keratin exoskeleton?
Chitin. Yeah, Titan. Keratin is us, chitin's insects.
Sorry.
That is an excellent question, and it leads into something called insect gigantism, because in the Carboniferous, you know, 200-300 million years ago, you had these huge griffin flies. Basically, people think they're dragon, you know, these giant dragonflies with like a 70-centimeter wingspan and stuff like that, that flew through the air and, you know, were terrifying and stuff. They're actually, they're related to dragonflies. They actually weren't dragonflies. They're called griffin flies, but they're the ancestors of those. But the question is, like, we see these other things like millipedes, that, you know, meter long millipedes, you know, just huge insects, you know, back then. And the question was, how did they get so big, and why are they not big today? One of the hypotheses is that the oxygen content of the atmosphere back then was higher. Temperatures were also higher. So did that facilitate larger body sizes? Because, you know, is there some limit to, you know, body size based on oxygen and so on and so forth? And there's correlations between body size and oxygen content, but it's a little more complicated than that, because back then there were large insects around, but there were not a lot of aerial predators to go after those large insects. And you kind of see a decline in large flying insects when you see a rise in possible aerial predators, either other animals or the insects and things like that. So it's a little complicated. There's a lot of little threads to tease out of there. Another thing is that we have a lot of large insects around today. We just don't really think about it that much. You know, there are some beetles that are very large. So, you know, it's possible that oxygen content and oxygen delivery does limit body size. That is a possibility. And it is a, you know, it's a working hypothesis, and people investigate things like that. One thing that we're interested in doing is scanning some fossils of these, what we call stem odonates, these griffin flies, these huge Meganeuropsis, you know, dragon griffin flies that flew around in the Carboniferous, and see if we can estimate from looking at the body size and the wing size and some other correlates that we can use, what did their tracheal system look like? Did they have lots of air sacs? Can we tell? Trachea don't fossilize well at all. And all the fossils that I've looked at, I've seen one, and they can kind of see it in the leg, and that's sort of it. But we're trying to do some correlations between existing dragonflies and damselflies, and some measurements like wing size and body size and the tracheal investiture and the living ones, and size, and see, can we make some estimates on like what it might have been like back then? So, but yeah, it is. Insect gigantism, I think that one of the ways that insects get larger is by exploiting air spaces, because it's cheaper. You know, otherwise you have to generate, you know, hemolymph and tissues and stuff like that. It's a lot easier to just fill something up with air. You're able to get larger, you look larger, so that you're getting larger is a really great way of not being eaten. And so, and also looking attractive to mates and things like that, you know, rhinoceros beetles, that's one of the things that one of the reasons they do that, sexual selection for, you know, for females. But yeah, I think one of the ways that a lot of insects get larger is through air spaces. So some of it is for flight, some of it is just to be large. So
cool. That was awesome. We're right up against the last kind of question. So first things first, did we skip anything you want to mention before we get to the traditional last question?
I don't think so. I think thank you. So first off, thank you for reading my paper. A lot of it is, you know, so in a lot of these works, you have to do what are called telegraphic descriptions, you know, remaining branch runs anterior ad with connection from, it's like, you know, when we were writing this, we're like, can't we just, you know, you can see the picture, you know, you can just look at that and it says it, but you actually have to write it out too. So that it's pretty tedious to read, and if you read any of it, thank you very much. So there's a lot of, basically it's you know, the front part is interesting to read and the back part's interesting to read, and the middle is very like dense anatomical descriptions that were very painstaking to write. So if you read any of those, thank you very much.
And just for listeners, that is almost the case with every single research paper. Read the abstract, the intro, the discussion, and the conclusion, and if you have questions or the ability to go back, then read the methodology. Because normally you can get what you need without, and you won't pull out the little hair you have left. In my case, it's almost gone. Yeah, a couple of bald dudes here. Yep. Okay, so it is time for the traditional last question here on Whimsical Wavelengths, loved or dreaded or both. What is your favorite science joke?
So, a computer scientist, a physicist, and a chemist are at a bar and they're debating whose science is the most fundamental. And the chemist says, mine is the most fundamental because it deals with how does matter work? How do these, you know, how do atoms interface together, these different, you know, processes and chemical reactions, you know, how do these things, that chemistry is all about, you know, how does matter work? And the physicist says, physics is the most fundamental because it talks about like, what is matter made of? How do these things, you know, these different subatomic particles, how do they arise from the chaos to become these things? And the computer scientist like smiles and leans back and says, but where does the chaos come from? So yeah, computer science is all about chaos.
Oh boy.
It's not a very good joke.
It doesn't have to be a very good joke. That's the beauty of it all. I think in an early episode I used, why don't computer scientists make good gardeners? Because they don't have root access or something along that line. Anyway.
That's terrible.
Hey, that's my mantra. The more terrible, the better. So yeah, thanks for coming on. It's been great. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it. It's been fun.
And with that, another episode comes to a close. Thanks for joining me on this whimsical exploration of the breathing apparatuses of insects. Remember, leave a review. Give me some feedback. And I'll see you guys in 2 weeks.
Lost in the fog of a cosmic storm, floating on whimsical wavelengths is the norm. Dancing through the stars, chasing spectrums of light. Riding the waves that are just out of sight. In a world so chaotic that misbehaves, melodies that echo show us six always. Colors intertwine, painting the sky. We're lost in the rhythm as the universe flies by. Oh, we're tuned in, feeling the beat of the unknown. Can you hear it? It's echoing through your bones. In this melodic maze we live.